Good evening. A Cuomo brother is infected, thousands at risk in U.S. immigration jails, an aircraft carrier is stricken with the disease as tensions with Iran grow, and an Indian nation moves to legalize pot. With these and other stories, I'm Paul DiRienzo with some of the news for Tuesday, March 31st, 2020. The U.S. death toll from the coronavirus climbed past 3,600 Tuesday, eclipsing China's official count. New York City rushed to bring in more medical professionals and ambulances, and refrigerated morgue trucks were parked on the streets to collect the dead. The crisis hit home. It hit close to home for Governor Andrew Cuomo, who reported teary-eyed that his brother, CNN anchor Chris Cuomo, was infected.
I don't care how young, how old. This virus is the great equalizer. My brother Chris is positive for coronavirus, found out this morning. He is going to be fine. He's young, in good shape, strong, not as strong as he thinks, but he will be fine. But there's a lesson in this. He's an essential worker, member of the press, so he's been out there. If you go out there, the chance that you get infected is very high. I spoke to him this morning, and he's going to be quarantined in his basement at home. He's just worried about his daughter and his kids, that he hopes he didn't get them infected. You don't really know Chris. You know, you see Chris. He has a show on night, 9 o'clock on CNN. But you just see one dimension, right? You see a person in his job. And in his job, he's combative and he's argumentative and he's pushing people. But that's his job. That's really not who he is. He's a really sweet, beautiful guy. He's my best friend. My father was always working, so it was always just me and Chris.
Meanwhile, the New York Times reports today the White House is expected to release models showing the future course of the disease. The grim statistics predict 100,000 Americans or more will die because of COVID-19. The statistics are said to agree with a dozen different models studied by the Centers for Disease Control. Elsewhere around the world, the infection rate in Italy appears to be leveling off, but the crisis is far from over. Spain's hospital system is on the verge of collapse. Russia moved to crack down on quarantine violations and fake news about the outbreak. And China edged closer to normal as stores in the city of Wuhan began reopening. Worldwide, more than 800,000 people have been infected and over 40,000 have died, according to a tally kept by Johns Hopkins University. Italy and Spain accounted for half the deaths, while the U.S. had over 180,000 infections, with more dead than China's official toll of about 3,300. New York was the nation's deadliest hotspot, with about 1,550 deaths statewide, most of them in New York City. The Big Apple is expected to get worse by the weekend. Patients at Elmhurst Hospital, near the childhood home of President Trump, are filling every square foot of space as they wait for beds. Doctors say they've never seen anything like it. A 1,000-bed emergency hospital set up at the Mammoth Javits Convention Center began taking non-coronavirus patients as the Navy hospital ship Comfort, with 1,000 beds, was expected to begin accepting patients today. The indoor tennis center that is the site of the U.S. Open tournament is being turned into a hospital as well. The city also worked to bring in 250 out-of-town ambulances and 500 paramedics to deal with the crush of emergency calls. Last week was the busiest in the history of the city's emergency medical services. Nearly 80,000 former nurses, doctors, and others have volunteered to help. Cities across the nation are facing challenges they never expected to see. Tens of thousands of kids locked up in juvenile jails are facing the reality of the looming crisis. Staffers have tested positive at juvie facilities in New York, Delaware, Minnesota, Texas, Connecticut, and Louisiana. In New York City, the Rikers Island jail complex and nearby lockups alone have seen seen the number of positive cases jump tenfold to more than 320 in just 2 weeks. But as one Louisiana advocate says, the 43,000 minors in America's detention centers and correctional facilities seem to be an afterthought. Also, at least 38,000 detainees are in immigration jails across the country. Members of the Congressional Hispanic Caucus held a telephone conference today to demand the immediate release of ICE detainees. The caucus chair, Congressman Joaquin Castro, was joined by other members, including New York's Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
These four confirmed cases of immigrants in custody who have coronavirus and five ICE facility employees who have tested positive. That was as of yesterday. Immigrants are staging peaceful protests and hunger strikes to be released out of concern for their lives and subpar detention conditions. And ICE has responded with pepper spraying, beatings, and solitary confinement. These horrific and inhumane conditions are happening right now here in our country. Thankfully, we've seen some judges order the release of just a handful of vulnerable immigrants in custody. It also appears that ICE may be quietly releasing a few immigrants in some detention facilities, but this simply isn't enough. And I frankly don't understand why ICE is not taking the necessary steps to reduce their detention numbers. It doesn't make sense that the federal government would be releasing people from prisons, but won't do the same for ICE detainees. Their detention is a civil matter, not a criminal one. Every day that ICE slow walks their response to the coronavirus means they're choosing to risk thousands of lives who are in detention. And we've seen the similar spread, very quickly in confined areas. The cruise ships, for example, and other confined spaces where it becomes very dangerous for the people who are detained in those spaces, who are kept in those spaces. We're here to ask ICE and the Trump administration to release these detainees. My colleague from California, Congresswoman Linda Sanchez.
We are here to ring the alarm bell because in the middle of this national health emergency, the administration is letting a very vulnerable population sit atop a virtual powder keg. The White House chooses to ignore this situation. As if that wasn't bad enough, the conditions in these detention centers have proven in the past that there is a lack of appropriate medical care, and this puts migrants at an increased risk for contracting what is a very deadly virus, the COVID-19 virus. If an outbreak were to happen in a detention facility, that's just like dry tinder. It would just spread through that facility like wildfire. As of yesterday, there were four confirmed cases of COVID-19 among detainees and five confirmed cases among detention facility staff. Well, as of last Thursday, there were also three confirmed cases among children in ORR custody. And those are just the number of known cases. And as we've seen with coronavirus, for every known case, for every person that has tested positive and is known to have it, there may be hundreds or thousands that they've come into contact with that have the virus as well. They just don't know it. We can have a sort of humanitarian type parole as an alternative to detention in a facility.
Right now, we have New Yorkers that are in Bergen, Essex, and Hudson County jails, and there are confirmed coronavirus infections at all three of these detention facilities. This is an absolute crisis. I also represent Rikers Island, and I can tell each and every single one of you, there is no time between the first case being confirmed and just a massive outbreak in these facilities. People are being put in cages in close proximity. They do not belong there. They pose, most of them pose no threat to society. They're simply waiting on their court date. And I have constituents in Bergen County. The situation is so bad that there are now hunger strikes at each of these locations, Bergen, Essex, and Hudson County jails. And a decision to do nothing is a decision to do harm. I knew that this was happening. I myself have driven to LaGuardia Airport and saw them transporting children into an epicenter, into New York City, to ORR facilities as well, where we also know that the staffers who are taking care of these children have confirmed coronavirus cases as well.
Next is Noreen Shaw, the Senior Advocacy and Policy Counsel on Immigrants' Rights at the ACLU.
I want to highlight in particular CBP custody, which has gotten a lot less focus. CBP continues to apprehend hundreds of people every day. We know that in February, CBP took over 30,000 individuals and families into custody at or in between ports of entry at the southern border. Many of the CBP facilities, including almost all Border Patrol stations, did not provide detained people with access to sinks or showers. We know that people are held in freezing temperatures with inedible food, insufficient potable water, and reports from recently detained people indicate that agents have denied access to hand sanitizer and soap and held individuals in cells with other people exhibiting flu-like symptoms. The ACLU has filed 7 cases for release of ICE detainees in Washington, Maryland, Pennsylvania, Massachusetts, Central and Northern California, and New Jersey, and we will be filing more. Today, the court in our Pennsylvania case, Thacker v. Dahl, granted a temporary restraining order in our favor, ordering the release of 13 detained individuals, and we expect more decisions in the coming days. Our lawsuits argue that the Constitution's due process clause requires release for detainees who are medically vulnerable. The Fifth Amendment of the Constitution guarantees that civil detainees, including all immigrant detainees, are not subjected to punishment. The federal government violates this substantive due process right when it subjects civil detainees to cruel treatment and conditions of confinement that amount to punishment or does not ensure those detainees' safety and health. Our lawsuits also make clear that ICE has the discretion right now to release detained individuals. That discretion applies regardless of the statutory basis for a non-citizen's detention. They not only have the discretion, they've done it. Ultimately, no one, whether they are a citizen or an immigrant, should be forced to live in conditions that imperil their lives during this public health crisis. ICE and CBP must do the responsible thing, release people in detention, starting with the most vulnerable, to keep them safe from COVID-19 before it is too late.
ORR is the Office of Refugee Resettlement, a component of the Department of Homeland Security, responsible for jailing child immigrants. CBP is the United States Customs and Border Protection Agency. And you're listening to the news on WBAI New York. I'm Paul DiRienzo. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said today the coronavirus pandemic will not stop the United States from waging retaliatory attacks against Iranian-backed militia groups that launched strikes on American outposts in Iraq. We will always respond to protect and defend Americans, Pompeo told reporters on Tuesday when asked about recent attacks by Iranian armed militia groups in Iraq. The coronavirus has not impacted the United States' ability to respond, Pompeo added, despite reports of at least 100 cases of COVID-19 on one aircraft carrier alone. Reese Ehrlich is an award-winning journalist. He currently writes the nationally distributed Foreign Correspondent column. He says the Trump administration is using the pandemic as a cover for its military moves against Iran.
The administration is taking advantage of the focus of the media and people's attention on the coronavirus epidemic. And meanwhile, 2 aircraft carriers are on their way to the Persian Gulf, and there's almost daily tit-for-tat military strikes between the U.S. on the one hand and Iran-allied militias who are part of the Iraqi army on the other.
This hasn't been reported very much in the media, has it?
If you look carefully in the back pages of the New York Times, you'll find it. By and large, it's not been certainly played up, partly because the Trump administration has not made a big deal about it, which therefore means the media don't make a big deal about it. But it's a very serious situation.
And why is that a serious situation?
The danger is that the tit-for-tat strikes, which each side thinks is limited and will be interpreted benignly by the other, can actually get out of hand. So, for example, the U.S. assassinated Qasem Soleimani, one of the top leaders of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard, back in January. And that assassination rippled throughout the region, not only impacting Iraq, but Iran and other countries in the region, because for the first time, the U.S. asserts the right to assassinate a leader of an army that we're not even at war with. And it angered people in Iraq, it angered people in Iran, and led to a military strike by the Iranians against U.S. bases in Iraq. Luckily, that was the end of that round. The U.S. did not in turn retaliate. But the danger is there that either side could miscalculate and start a much wider war.
Is this something that's just out of control, or is this just macho posturing that could get out of control, or is there some strategy here?
There's definitely a plan by the United States, which is, you have to go back to 2018 when the U.S. unilaterally pulled out of the nuclear accord with Iran, violating international law, violating U.N. resolutions. Trump did it because he could get away with it. The Iranians waited roughly a year, hoping that the Europeans would actually live up to the agreement, engage in trade and investment, and defy the U.S. Unilateral illegal actions. But the Europeans basically dropped the ball. So Iran and its allies started making various kinds of attacks on tankers. The Iranians seized a British tanker at one point. There was the attack on the Saudi oil fields and the Aramco oil fields by missiles and drones. What the U.S. started, the Iranians are following through on.
Poor Iraq, they're not really either Iran or the United States, and I think their Congress didn't vote to, their parliament didn't vote to eject U.S. troops who are still there.
Iraq had been going through a major tumult, huge demonstrations, hundreds of thousands of people at one point demonstrating in central Baghdad, demanding an end to corruption, demanding normal infrastructure like electricity and water, but also demanding that both the U.S. and Iran get out of Iraq. The Iraqis have had it with war since 2003. They don't want to be occupied by either power. When the Soleimani assassination took place, it shifted the political balance, and people started calling for mainly the U.S. getting out because of the outrage that people had towards that assassination. Today, the parliament did indeed vote to call for the removal of all foreign forces, U.S., Iran, Britain, everybody who's got troops in Iraq. The new prime minister is seeking to be approved by the parliament, and we'll have to see what his stand is going to be on that. The U.S. is very much in a weakened position politically as a result of that assassination.
Mentioning the pandemics, and you brought that up, how does that relate? Because Iran is becoming an epicenter. I'm not sure what the situation in Iraq is. How is that playing into this, into the U.S. military, which is, we don't even know how extensive the infections are in the militaries of either country?
Yeah, I think it's weakening both countries politically, if not militarily. Iran has been hit badly by the coronavirus. There's 2,900 dead so far, 44,000 cases in Iran. There's been fewer reported cases in Iraq. That may be because their health system is so shattered by the war and occupation that they're simply not testing and therefore don't really know how bad the outbreak is in Iraq. There's a U.S. aircraft carrier in the Pacific that now has 100 confirmed cases of coronavirus on board the ship. So certainly for the Navy, the coronavirus poses a real serious problem.
And that's Reese Ehrlich. He's a writer, a former award-winning journalist, and currently writes the nationally distributed Foreign Correspondent column. The commanding officer of the aircraft carrier Theodore Roosevelt has been urging the Navy to step up its response to COVID-19 as cases aboard the ship continue to multiply. And during a White House coronavirus briefing in the Rose Garden on Sunday, President Trump suggested hospitals had squandered supplies of masks and were hoarding ventilators. He also said states were requesting equipment they didn't need.
As to hoarding of ventilators, some hospitals and independent hospitals and some hospital chains, as we call them, they are holding ventilators. They don't want to let them up. We need them for certain areas where there's big problems. Can't hold them if they think there might be a problem weeks down the road.
The claims were unsubstantiated and denied by the governors of various states. And in a dramatic confrontation, PBS White House correspondent Yamiche Alcindor used Trump's own words to ask the president if he intended to shortchange governors who have publicly criticized him.
You said repeatedly that you think that some of the equipment that governors are requesting, they don't actually need. You said New York might need, not need 30,000. You said it on Sean Hannity's Fox News. You said,
you know,
that
let me ask you.
You said
why
some
don't you act? Why don't you act in a little more positive? It's always trying to
my
get
question
you,
to you.
Get
is,
you, get you. And you know what? That's why nobody trusts the media anymore.
My
that's
question
why
to you people, is, how is that going to impact?
Excuse me, you didn't hear me. That's why you used to work for the Times and now you work for somebody else. Look, let me tell you something. Be nice. Don't
Mr.
be
President,
threatening.
My question
Don't
is,
be threatening.
Later, Alcindor tweeted in response that she was not the first human being, woman, black person, or journalist to be told she should be nice while doing her job. In other news, a man suspected of planning to attack a Missouri hospital facing the coronavirus crisis was killed during a shootout with FBI agents last week. The suspected white supremacist, 36-year-old Timothy Wilson, was on the verge of trying to detonate a car bomb at a Kansas City area medical center, according to the FBI. Wilson espoused white supremacist ideology and made a threat that if any agent attempted to search his property, they would bring a lot of body bags. Wilson was associated with former soldier Jared Smith, who was arrested for providing bomb-making information in September 2019 while still stationed at Fort Riley, Kansas. And on Monday, federal judges lifted restrictions in Texas, Ohio, and Alabama imposed on abortion providers during the coronavirus pandemic. Iowa, Mississippi, and Oklahoma are among the other states that recently moved to suspend access to the procedure as the pandemic intensified, arguing it would preserve desperately needed medical supplies. The overturned Texas order threatened a $1,000 fine or 180 days of jail time on abortion providers who violated the ban. And finally, a referendum to legalize both medicinal and recreational cannabis use has been approved in South Dakota by an Indian tribe. The Oglala Sioux tribe voted to pass a referendum allowing cannabis on the Pine Ridge Reservation. It would make the Oglala the only tribe to set up a cannabis market in a state where it's otherwise illegal. Tribal Council 5th member Ricky Gray Grass is a supporter of the measure. He spoke with WBAI.
We're the first tribe to move forward with this in a illegal state still. And so we're using our sovereign rights, inherent rights, and treaty rights to move this cannabis legalization, the cannabis on the reservation, where in a state where it's illegal in South Dakota. But we're pushing forward to make this happen. You know, we still got to reach out to the state, to work with the state, and to work with federal agents. And so that's being in the process. And that's where we're at now.
There's some history there, and it was an attempt to legalize hemp and to make building materials out of hemp, and there were some problems right from the beginning. There's been resistance. How have you been trying to overcome that resistance?
We've been taking a more precautious approach with this, reaching out with attorneys to help us with the language in the tribal ordinance. What happened with the hemp back in 1999 with Alex Whiteplume, he won his cases on treaty rights. His court always got dismissed at the Eighth Circuit. Finally, you know, hemp is we have a hemp program here. And, you know, he's been the only one that's been still farming. Well, with the Farm Act, I think this year we're going to have a lot more farmers in the hemp industry.
You know, alcohol's been a real problem, as it is everywhere in America. And is this seen as sort of a, from the health perspective, not just if there's a financial perspective, we can get into that for a minute, but there's also a health perspective here that marijuana would be a safer alternative to alcohol use, for example.
Yep. Yeah, maybe a lot safer. I mean, there's a high percentage of alcoholism on our reservation. We're supposedly to be a dry reservation, you know, but couple years back, 4 years back, they closed down a border town of White Clay, Nebraska that was selling millions of cans of beer to our reservation. And when they closed that down, you know, they, it seemed like the alcoholism picked up even more with our bootlegging in the communities and within our tribe. Looking at it as an approach to curb that is with legalizing cannabis, you know, medicinally and recreationally.
It also could be a source of funding. You've had some reservations done very well with gambling, for example.
I know it's going to be a bigger revenue. I know it'll generate more money. We have two casinos. I know one's on the eastern side, one's on the western side. But I know with the legalization of cannabis in an industry, I think it will bring in more money, but in both casinos. Right now, it's in a tribal ordinance that it's only for tribal enrolled members of the Oglala Sioux tribe that could apply for, you know, license to grow, license for dispensaries, you know, stuff like that.
Uh-huh. You're in a farm state. A lot of people know how to grow things pretty well. This would be something right up your alley. I mean, people can grow stuff.
Yeah, yeah. As soon as the tribe passes the ordinance, you know, and regulations are being written out and worked on, you know, as soon as those are passed tribal council, you know, past standing committees and goes in front of tribal council and passes. So we're still looking months ahead, but in the meantime, you know, where people are still anxious, are still ready to go, You know, there's people that's been doing it for years underground. But, you know, we have people that are knowledgeable in gardening hemp. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we've got a good head start.
Eventually, they're going to get legalization in New York State. And they're talking about, and a lot of other states have done this too, forgiving all the past convictions.
Yeah, that's what we was looking at too, was doing decriminalization with that, because we have a lot of people that are sitting in prisons and jails because of their conviction of the black market cannabis that wasn't happening. You know, that's what we're looking at, too.
To get them released, because once you legalize it, then why would you hold them? I mean, you're admitting you were wrong, right? And just to wrap up, how do you see this looking? In the best-case scenario, in a year or two down the road, how do you see this playing out in your area?
I think it's going to make a big difference. It's going to make a lot of difference here with our financial strap of federal funds and state funds we get. You know, it's going to help a lot of our programs out financially. With all the finances coming in, the revenue coming in from the cannabis industry, you know, and helping just the tribe in general with everything that we're struggling in, you know, because we always get the last small piece of the pie from federal funding, state funding, local funding that is out there. And we seem to be always satisfied with that funding that we get. So this is going to make a big impact on our reservation, you know, looking at dispensaries, we're looking at cannabis farms, or look maybe in the future looking at a cannabis resort, you know, cannabis lounges, stuff like that. So, you know, we've got a lot of people that come to the reservation throughout the summertime. So when the coronavirus is done and over with, you know, it's going to, by that time we should have all our laws in place passed. We should be making a big impact with our neighboring states, even with the state of South Dakota, people coming in. And it's going to go on South Dakota state ballot in November when they vote. So we're hoping to have a head start before the state, if it passes at the state level.
Be better than wall drugs, you know, instead of going to wall drugs, everybody to come to the reservation.
Ricky Gray Grass is fifth member of the Oglala Sioux Tribal Council. And that's some of the news for Tuesday, March 31st, 2020. The news is produced by Linda Perry. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson for the WBAI News.
For the WBAI News, he's Paul DiRienzo.